He's got the news and the views.
He's got views on the news.
It's the Rob Snow Show on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
Hey, it's Monday. Made it back to work. Made it to February. See y'all later, January. Get lost. Get out of here. Remember this day, okay? Ladies and gentlemen, later this year, you know, when it's hot and muggy and you're having trouble sleeping at night, maybe your air conditioner is broken and it's sweaty and it's sticky, and during the day you're not allowed to go to the beach and cool off because there's a pandemic. Remember this day. Remember this day and how cold it was. Minus 28.5 when I started my car this morning. That's what it said on my dash. Minus 28.5. And all I could think was, why do I live here again? Good morning. This is the Rob Snow Show, Rogers TV and City News. Great program lined up for you. Vaccines, again, major story for us. Canada is slipping behind other countries now when it comes to vaccinating its population. I have the data. It's just the data. How can you argue with the data? And the EU is talking tougher than it's ever talked before about export controls, and it's so worrying that cabinet ministers and the Trudeau government are forced to pick up the phone and plead Canada's case with their EU counterparts. Oh, please don't pick on us. Give us what we ordered. Please don't pick on us. You know what? It never had to be this way. You know it. I know it. Trudeau will never admit it. But it never had to be this way. We should be doing so much better than we are right now. And the simple fact is we're not. And it's Justin Trudeau's fault. You know, say what you will about the United States. Okay? Whatever you think of the United States. The United States administered more than 1 million doses in the last 24 hours of COVID vaccine. Between January 30th and January 31st, more than 1 million doses administered in a 24-hour period. We haven't even hit 1 million in total in this country yet. They're doing a million every 24 hours. Here, we've done 937,000 doses in all doses of two-dose vaccine. I mean, don't you ever stop and think, how can that possibly be? I mean, the very first dose of vaccine was administered to a Canadian December 14th, 2020. It's the 1st of February, 2021. 49 days later, not even 1 million doses administered yet. The United States managed to administer more than 1 million doses in 24 hours. This country has managed to, jab 947,000 people in 1,176 hours. And gosh, and to read the editorial pages, our political opponents, what are they upset? They're obsessed about who's going to be the next Governor General of Canada. Like, really? Does that really deserve as much speculation and news coverage as vaccinating Canadians? Who's going to live at Rideau Hall? Hum and haw over prorogation? What's more important, who lives at Rideau Hall or when Canadians will get vaccines into their arms so this hellscape of a pandemic can come to an end? Seriously, to my friends in the media, what is the more important story? Conservative MP Michelle Rempel-Garner will join me once again this morning, health critic for the official opposition. I spoke to her this morning. We'll also get into the whole issue of travel restrictions and quarantine hotels. I'd like your take on this as well. This is another part of the federal government's response to the pandemic that has done a 180. I mean, how many positions has this government had on travel restrictions from, we don't need travel restrictions. We don't need to do anything at the airport. Travel restrictions don't work. Don't be so xenophobic. And yet here we are, February 1st, 2021, all of these many, 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 many months later. Well, we can only have international flights land at these four airports. And if you land at one of these four airports, you will have to stay in a hotel for 3 days at your own cost. And it may cost you. How much could it cost you? Could cost you $2,000. And you think, I heard that. What did you think when you heard that, David? I thought immediately, did they say $2,000? It could cost $2,000?
I had to go back to the tape and they did in fact say
$2,000. $2,000 for a 3 day stay in a hotel in Canada? Like, where are they staying? I saw someone on Twitter say, are they staying at the Chateau Laurier? Well, I actually looked up the Chateau Laurier this morning on Trivago. Maybe somebody should introduce the federal government to Trivago. They have great deals on Trivago. You know, the guy who doesn't shave does the commercials for Trivago. David, you and I could stay tonight. Check in this afternoon, 4 o'clock this afternoon, whatever check-in time is, say 3 o'clock this afternoon, stay tonight. Tomorrow night, check out Wednesday morning at the Chateau Laurier for a grand total of $344 plus tax for the entire stay.
For both days. We'll have to go on a fact-finding mission.
Two nights and 3 days. But the government says, well, you have to stay at a government-approved hotel, and it could cost $2,000. Travel restrictions coming into force this week. It sounds government-approved hotels. That's probably the key right there, government-approved. It sounds like government-approved highway robbery to me. $2,000 for a 3 day stay in a hotel? What room have they booked? The Trudeau Suite? Going to get into all of that before noon today. And I welcome your take on any and all of these things. During our talk back hour that we do every morning between 10 and 11 o'clock, your phone calls, your opinions. It's the hottest radio in town. Why wouldn't you want to be part of it? Give me a call, 750-1310 after the 10 o'clock news, 750-1310, 613-750-1310. And the email address is therobsnowshow@ottawa.citynews.ca. Ottawa.citynews.ca. Therobsnowshow@ottawa.citynews.ca. I think as we make our way through the week, stay-at-home orders and curfews, they're going to come into focus without question. The Quebec curfew supposed to expire next week. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. Premier Legault will speak about that tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock. He says there could be some easing of restrictions for Quebec businesses, but it doesn't sound as though he is going to end the curfew anytime soon. Meantime, all across Ontario, we're living under this stay-at-home order. It, too, is supposed to expire sometime next week, Tuesday, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Now, you could argue these measures seem to be working. I think you could make that case. Given where we were and where we are with case counts, the stay-at-home order. Case counts, hey, let's face it, they're a lot lower than they were than when the order came into effect, a lot lower. So what should Doug Ford do? Say next week. When it comes time to lift or extend the stay-at-home order, what do you think Doug Ford should do? You know, it seems to be working, so you could argue, if it's working at driving case counts lower, why not keep doing it until the cases are a lot lower than they are now? Or is all of the other stuff that comes along with lockdowns and stay-at-home orders just, too much suffering? The businesses suffering, the isolation and the loneliness, the deteriorating mental health, all of that stuff. But now we have an additional issue, don't we? And that's the more contagious variants of COVID-19. And really, for government, how responsible would it be to lift any restrictions until more is known about the severity and the spread of those new variants of the disease. So look, it's a brand new week with brand new angles on the same old problem, the pandemic, here on the Rob Snow Show, Rogers TV, and City News.
Strong voice.
Strong opinions.
The Rob Snow Show returns on Rogers TV and City News.
101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
You've heard it said, downtown's a ghost town. Vacancies in downtown Ottawa's commercial real estate. What does that mean for opportunity for new commercial tenants in the core? Darren Fleming is with me. He is the CEO of Real Strategy Advisors. Good morning.
Hey, Rob, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
How's business?
Well, we took a little bit of a nap about springtime last year, but we seem to have woken up.
Okay. Woken up, and describe what it was like to wake up.
Well, heading into the holidays, I think a lot of folks were expecting that the restrictions were going to lift and that they'd be able to go back to the office in some capacity. I would say the executives that we speak to, and just in context, we deal primarily in tenant representation, representing small to medium businesses in the area, not-for-profit, for-profit professional services. So we have a lot of conversations about, hey, what are you thinking is going to happen?
Okay.
And most of these folks were feeling pretty good. And then I think January and the emergency order kind of took the wind out of our sails and slowed things down. But there's it's been almost a year, and there's a lot of companies now who have to do something. You know, they're not sure what the future holds. They know their lease is expiring, and the commercial lease is not like a residential lease. You can't just ignore it and go month to month. The legislation's different. Yeah, quite a bit different from residential. The residential legislation is to protect people from being thrown out on the street, whereas commercial, the understanding is that these are businesses, they get representation, and that there's a lot of investment capital sitting behind these buildings that need to know what's going on. So if a commercial tenant doesn't renew its lease, then the landlord gets lots of superpowers like, you know, getting them out on 30 days notice or doubling the rent, all as reasons to get the tenant to do something. So there's a lot of companies who
can move with a much more expedited fashion, by the sounds of things.
Correct.
As opposed to evicting, say, a residential tenant.
Yeah, there's no tribunal. There's no
right.
You know,
okay.
I think it's called the Landlord Tenancy Act now. But it used to be called the Tenant Protection Act, the residential one, and there was a reason. This one is much more business to business.
Right. Okay. So how would you describe the market right now? Is it soft?
That would be an understatement. I think the biggest thing that's happening right now is that everybody's demand for office space has decreased. We don't know how much of this hybrid, and I think categorizing the future of work as a hybrid between working from home and working in the office is the most likely scenario for most companies. But we really haven't lived in it yet. This is still a bit of speculation as to how well will we like it. You know, it's easy to say, you know, I'd like to spend half my time from the office, half the time in the office. But until you've lived it, you don't really know. But having said that, most executives are admitting, whether they like it or not, that they probably need less space than they did before. But many are a bit worried about jumping the gun too fast and finding out that they either have too little or too much. So we're doing a lot of short-term deals. But no one's growing. You know, it's very, very few tenants are growing, and very, very few of them are doing it downtown. Downtown, there are some people moving around, but generally speaking, they're shrinking from a much larger space to a medium-sized space, and that's about the only activity we have. There are a few organizations out there who, you know, whether it be the type of work they do or who they interact with, have to be in a physical office space. And those folks are finding that they have an unparalleled amount of choices.
An unparalleled amount of choices.
Well, let me give you an example.
Sure.
So I'm working with a national not-for-profit who is looking for around 10,000 square feet. So in pre-COVID times, when everybody had a desk that was theirs, that would have generally been around 50 people. And normally I would have seen, 10 to 15 decent options to consider. We would narrow that down to, half a dozen or so, go out and visit them, try to get down to two or three, and then start negotiating. Well, this time there was 30 options, good options. I really didn't actually know how to whittle this down with my client. They turned to me asking, how can we start to narrow this a little bit? And, really we're a bit at a loss. I've never seen this in my whole career, and I've been doing this for 20 years.
Wow. Okay. When it comes to things like having to make retrofits, I mean, you mentioned 10,000 square feet, housing so many employees. I mean, things like open concept and shared space and all of these things. Is all of that gone now? Are we going to be back to the days of, people actually wanting their own desk, their own office, whatever the case might be? I mean, just how much work needs to be done to commercial real estate to respect things like staying 6 feet apart, social distancing, all of these things?
Well, I make this joke. I liken it to the best person for a tailor to know is a personal trainer. Because the personal trainer takes someone, puts them through a big workout regime, gets their diet straightened out, and all of a sudden their body changes and they need a whole new wardrobe. Well, we've all been hitting the gym, in terms of office space. And, we don't know what we need yet, but we know it's going to be different. I don't think there's anybody who would say that the configuration, the way they did it before, is likely to be the same. There will be some outliers. There will be some senior executives that say, once it's safe, I want all my people back in. But what we found, and this was pre-COVID, is that applying a unilateral approach to any group of humans just didn't work. There were some people who had needs that were different than others, and that was often personal situation or preference rather than job description based. And so we're starting to lean heavily on what's called an activity-based work philosophy. And that's not new. This has been around for a while, but has certainly come back as, the technology that enables us to work, when and where we choose, has gotten smaller, lighter, cheaper. So this idea of coming into the office to do the type of work that either you want to do or that is best done in person will mean that when we come into an office, I think it's safe to say it's largely going to be made up of the bulk of meeting with others, either for social reasons because you're going crazy at home or because you want to share some ideas. There will be some folks who just don't want to work at home for whatever reason. They've got school-age kids at home and it's just not conducive to concentrating. They've got a roommate who's a slob and just can't keep the dirty hamburger wrappers off kitchen table. I think if we envision that office space becoming more of a collaborative hub, well, then that means it's going to happen in a couple of different ways. You're going to be meeting in open areas, but you're also going to have times when you either don't want to distract others or you're going to want to leverage some technology. And so I think we're going to see a few more enclosed spaces, medium-sized rooms that have a screen for those team members who either have to or are choosing to be remote that day. We've heard some executives talk about, Tuesdays and Thursdays will be in the office days, except that's not how it works. You can't put the whole company on that basis because otherwise you need more space on Tuesdays and Thursdays and no space on the off days. So there's going to be some recasting of that social contract between the employer and the employee as opposed in terms of what it means to be an employee of these companies.
Right.
Of working.
Okay. So let me ask you, when you say a lot of your clients are looking for more of a short-term deal as opposed to a traditional deal, what's short-term in your business?
So generally speaking, we would have normally done 5-year leases.
A 5-year is the traditional. Okay.
Yeah. Unless you're a bit larger, because it takes you a while to make big decisions, or you're doing major construction. So just to make the numbers work, you'd stretch it over 10 years.
Okay.
But what a lot of folks are worried about is, what if we get it wrong? What if we go down to 25 or 40% of less space than we had before and find out that we missed the mark? So there's a whole lot of folks who are trying to hedge their bets, I guess, for lack of a better.
So like 1 year, 2 years?
1 and 2 years were very common, I'd say up until about 5 or three or four months ago. We're now seeing some folks say, okay, we've been doing this for close to a year. We're pretty sure that most people are not want to come back. So we're now starting to do some three or four. There are a few we're starting to do some long term, because they've said no matter what, we don't need what we had before. We need to do something different.
What would you say is the price per square foot these days? Is that how you still measure it?
It is.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit tricky because unlike residential, where this, you know, the if you sell your home, it's public information. It may be a bit tricky to get the data, but it is publicly available. Office leasing's not.
Okay.
In office leasing, we break things up into two big chunks. We have what's called the operating costs, taxes, and utilities portion, or we call that the additional rent. And that's usually about half. And the other half, the base rent, is the money the landlord connects that they get to put in their pocket, pay their mortgage, you know, disperse to shareholders, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So most institutional investors, being pension funds, real estate investment trusts, sort of the big entity, life insurance companies, the big entities that own most of our downtown real estate, they care a lot about keeping that base rent number high. But what's starting to happen, and we've seen this after big recessions, is they'll start giving you some free rent and blending it over the term. Or they'll say, well, what if you move to our building and you don't have to pay rent for a year, and we're going to do that outside of your actual lease. So if you were to move on July 1st, 2021, your lease doesn't actually start until 2022. And maybe we'll give you an increased amount of cash, whereas before we might have given you, you know, half the cost of construction to build out your space. Many landlords are finding that if they don't pay for all of it, they don't get any looks. And so if you factor in all those things, that drives down what we call the effective rent. So
okay,
let's say your base rent is $20, and I get $10 of incentives of various amounts from landlords. Over a five-year lease, just using simple math, that would be $2 a year. So my effective rent would be
$18. $18. Okay.
All that.
All right. Okay.
So, but the other thing that's a little funny, and I liken this, having watched the tech bubble burst in Canada, the fallout from 2008, and now, usually when the storm hits, a lot of landlords like to put their head in the sand and hope the lightning bolt hits their neighbor. So nobody wants to be the first to drop their rent. There are a few developers out there who like to lead the pack, and having been a landlord leasing guy in the past, you know, you really have two choices. You either lead the market by being the first to lower your prices or increase incentives. And generally speaking, if all else is equal, you lease first. But you may have locked into a long-term rate that maybe undermines the value of your building or at least decreases it. Whereas others might choose to follow the market. So they're going to hold their prices and be content with vacancy until they have to admit to their board, their shareholders, the commercial appraiser that, you know what, it's just not worth the same as it did before.
Okay, we got to run, Darren. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, Darren Fleming on commercial real estate in Ottawa, CEO Real Strategy Advisors. The news coming up on City News.
The world is changing.
So keep up with Rob.
The Rob Snow Show returns on Rogers TV and City News. 101.1 FM and 1310 AM.
At the City of Ottawa, the Anti-Racism Secretariat will host a series of virtual public engagement sessions with diverse communities of racialized residents to plan targeted actions and inform the so-called six priority areas. You should register for these, according to the City of Ottawa. You go to engage.ottawa.ca. But let's talk a little bit more about some of these issues with Ralston King. He's the city councillor for Rideau-Rockcliffe Ward. He's the city liaison for anti-racism and ethno-cultural relations. Good morning, councillor.
Good morning.
Welcome back. Very nice to hear from you. So, 2020, I've heard it described many ways. I've heard it called an awakening, but also a reckoning. How would you describe the events of 2020 in terms of race in Ottawa?
I think that's accurate. I think, race has always been a challenge, especially ensuring that people have equity of opportunity and equity of outcome, especially when they're dealing with their governments just generally. And so when I came to office in April 2019 in the by-election. You know, there was a lot of elation in the community, first elected black official in the city's history.
Yep.
And then literally a month later, there was, dejection, frustration, when a resident in my ward had the N-word spray-painted on their door. This family had this word spray-painted. And the community came to me and said, of course, there's always these acts of individual racism, but the one thing we can't tolerate is systemic racism, challenges of discrimination when we are dealing with our government. The expectation is that everybody should be treated fairly when before their government are accessing services. So that was the genesis of the idea of an anti-racism secretariat. The community itself said, you know, we wanted to take this teachable moment and turn it into something tangible. And that's why I'm so gratified that at this point, a year and a bit later, nearly going on to 2 years since I've been elected, we made a lot of progress at the city in terms of equity and diversity, creating an anti-racism office that will deal with these policy challenges.
Okay. Six priority areas. What are some of the priority areas?
Employment equity. So these areas, this is what I'm also proud of, is that the community themselves created these ideas. Employment equity. So the feeling is that, you know, we might not want to be looking at specific targeted numbers, but the reality is when you look at the city's workforce, there's an expectation that it should reflect the city that it's serving. And we know that in terms of racialized people, there are only 12.5% or 12.5% people employed who are racialized at the city. Our general population is about 25%. So people do want access to employment opportunities.
Okay.
They want to ensure that there's equity in governance so that the city's boards and commissions look like the city. They want to ensure better health outcomes, better opportunities in terms of housing, in terms of youth, and in terms of economic development. They want to be able to ensure that different communities have access to the contracts that the city issues. So, there was a key focus on these priorities. This is what the community actually themselves determined should be the priorities. And this is what they're talking about, what they'll be talking about during the virtual consultation sessions that will occur all throughout this month.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, you said 25% of the Ottawa population would be a visible minority racialized residents. Is that
That's
what you
correct.
Said? And it's about 12.5% is actually the makeup of the workforce of the city of Ottawa.
That's correct.
And I suspect that probably, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Councillor, it thins out the higher you go?
Absolutely.
It does?
That's one of the larger challenges. I mean, both the senior leadership team at the city, so the senior bureaucrats, and the political people who, I sit around the council table with, look at the leadership team and, have stated to me, and, you notice this when you're at a council meeting. We unfortunately sit virtually now.
Yes,
but we were sitting physically. The senior leadership team.
It's a pretty white place, right?
Absolutely. And that doesn't reflect the reality of the city. And so, the idea is that we want to ensure that we have more people have opportunities, job opportunities that will lead to senior leadership positions eventually.
How do you do that?
Well, I think with respecting
things like merit and qualifications and things like that, right?
Well, this is the key issue, is that we need to have people around the table first. And we often talk about merit and all these challenges, but, it's hard to really see forward momentum if people aren't around the table in the first place. That is a large challenge. We know that looking at non-racialized job seekers versus black job seekers, there are huge gaps in terms of people being able to access work opportunities. In fact, there's been many studies that have determined that, you're three times less likely of obtaining a callback for a job if you have a Black-sounding name. 65% of employers will reject qualified Black job seekers due to credentialism. There are all sorts of challenges especially Black Canadians have that create massive disadvantages in the job hiring process. And that's part of the systemic problem that needs to be addressed. And I think once we have, more people in the workforce, then we will have a greater opportunity for them to really seek that job advancement into the senior leadership ranks.
Okay. What does Black History Month mean in Ottawa for you, Councillor King?
To me, it is really an acknowledgement of the amazing work and the amazing history that Black people have really undertaken. To me, our history, Black history, outlines the journey that we've undertaken to overcome massive challenges to human rights, political rights, and also to our socioeconomic potential. And it's a history that really shows us that we're not just surviving, but we're thriving, and we're continuing to really weave a rich cultural tapestry into the history of this country. So to me, it's a question of looking back so that we build strength as we move forward. Because I really believe, I look at the youth all the time, I believe that our potential really is limitless. And we have a strong next generation who wants to take the mantle and really move forward with the pursuit of racial equality and equity. So to me, history is looking back so that we could build a strong foundation to really move forward and make real progress for many communities in our city and also in our country.
Okay. Thank you, Councillor, for your time. Very interesting, sir.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, always great. Ralston King, City Councillor, Rita Rockliff Ward. He's the city liaison for anti-racism and ethno-cultural relations. Coming up next, Michelle Rempel-Gardner is the health critic for the official opposition. She's the member of parliament for Calgary Nose Hill. She'll join me next here on City News.
Firm.
Fair.
Fun.
The Rob Snow Show returns
on Rogers TV and City News, 101.1 FM
and 1310 AM.
Well, it's a cold day in the capital this morning. We're talking about what I think is the biggest story in the country, and that is the slow pace of the vaccination rollout in Canada. And once more, pleased to welcome back to the Rob Snow Show Michelle Rempel-Gardner, Conservative Member of Parliament and the health critic for the official opposition. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Look, it's a great pleasure. I want to begin with the situation in the EU, where member countries in the EU will have a say, each one of them, over export controls, over vaccine exports. And there's a great rush for clarity now on what this could mean for Canada. What's your understanding of it?
Well, we're trying to get to the bottom of it. Over the weekend, Conservative members, we used some parliamentary procedure to compel the minister responsible for the file to come to committee. So we'll be dealing with that today and then hopefully pressing her for answers. But at the end of the day, my big question is, how is Canada not exempt from this if the government is saying everything's okay? And also, if you rewind back to about a year ago when people around or countries around the world were being really protectionist or like really, secure with their personal protective equipment, how did the government not think that that wouldn't happen with vaccines? So certainly this is one aspect of a very important story, and it's important because a lot of our vaccines that the government has contracted for, a vast majority, are supposed to be produced in the EU.
What other questions do you have? I know one that keeps coming up, Michelle Rempel-Gardner, among my listeners, is why are we getting the Canadian supply of, for example, the Pfizer vaccine from Brussels or Belgium to begin with? Why aren't we getting it, for example, from Kalamazoo, Michigan? Is that a question you have as well?
I think it actually leads to an even broader one, which is why did the federal government do nothing to allow us to produce vaccines at home? I mean, you could use the United Kingdom as an example. They really didn't have a lot of capacity to produce vaccines, less than a year ago, but they spent a lot of effort to ensure that they had domestic production capacity, knowing that a vaccine was coming. Why didn't that happen here? I mean, why would we be beholden to other countries when the government tried to make the same efforts for things like masks, right? It just seems really dumb, to be honest with you, but like I'm more frustrated. I want the government to succeed in getting us vaccines. It's just there's not a lot of answers forthcoming yet. And this coming week, we've got a series of very high-profile committee meetings, which I'm sure a lot of Canadians will be watching, where we will be pressing for answers and, more importantly, a way forward and some hope.
Well, you're a Calgary area member of Parliament. I'm sure it must be with great frustration that you read or watch the stories about a company in your own neck of the woods like Providence Therapeutics and the frustration that company had in trying to advance its own mRNA technology, because it seemed that it didn't really get very far, and the funding that it did finally receive 5 months later was a vastly lower than what it had applied for. How frustrating was that for you to read about that story of the company?
It boggles my mind that we don't have that capacity, knowing that this was going to be needed. Now, the vaccines that are being produced by Pfizer, Moderna, others, they're on new technological platforms. Like, they're not necessarily the same as what somebody would traditionally think of as a vaccine. So we need new technology to produce that. But that said, I mean, if you think back to the Great Wars, I mean, auto manufacturer plants were retooled to produce tanks and planes. Surely we could have looked nationally and said, okay, what capacity do we have? How can we retrofit this and get ready? I'm also not sure that the government even bothered to negotiate the right to produce those vaccines in Canada. So even if we had the production capacity, would we be able to do it? Those are questions the government needs to answer, and we need to turn this around, right? I think what we're going to be pressing the government for is a concrete, and we have been pressing them for, is a concrete way forward. How are we fixing these problems, and what is a reasonable timeline for Canadians to expect their vaccines? I mean, we can't.
Well, they still say by the end of March. They still say by the end of March. What do you think about that? How all of this could happen, and yet we don't skip a beat, and everything arrives here by the end of March.
Okay, so this is my math. I'm going to use the September timeline.
Okay. Right.
So, Trudeau keeps saying everybody who wants a vaccine will be able to get one in Canada by September. All of these vaccines are being targeted towards adults. We have about roughly 30 million adults in Canada. There's about 30-some weeks left to September. So on that pace, you need roughly, and all those vaccines require two doses. On that pace, we need about 2 million doses per week coming into the country or produced here on average, in order to meet that timeline. So last week, we had 0 out of 2 million. This week, I think we'll have one, we're going to be like 1.9 million short at best, and probably about the same in weeks to come. So unless the government, and I hope they can do this, is planning on pulling a massive rabbit out of their hat sometime in the late summer, that target's just not feasible. And it's not just my word for it. Like, there's an article in The Economist published saying that Canada was well into 2022 in terms of likelihood of being able to meet that type of a target. And what that means is that we don't have a path towards people getting out of lockdown, getting their jobs back, and more importantly, ensuring that, the lives of vulnerable persons in Canada are protected. So, you just basic math pokes some holes in his argument. And I think this is the first argument Trudeau can't really fudge, right? Because it's a tangible product that you either have it or you don't. And so we do want the government to succeed, but they need to start turning some of their stuff around. I think admitting a problem is the first step.
What is your opinion on the pace of approvals by Health Canada of some of the other vaccines? For example, AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson, now Novavax has applied for approval. Seems to be taking longer than other countries. How frustrating is that for you?
Well, I mean, that's really a question for Health Canada officials. As a, you know, as a politician, I don't want to be pronouncing on the efficacy of a vaccine. That said, you know, AstraZeneca has been approved, like you said. It's already being deployed in the UK. But the challenges you and I have been talking about still apply, I believe, to AstraZeneca, right? Like, it's supposed to be manufactured in the EU. What happens if there's export restrictions? We really haven't built up capacity here at home. So those, again, it's not necessarily just because there's another one approved. That's great, but when are we getting those doses? So, you know, it's the same issues with a different candidate. So, of course, we'll be tying into that issue around approval, but the process that we've been talking about, and that is a politician, that is the Prime Minister's responsibility, is something that they need to admit that there's challenges with right now. I haven't heard him say that. And from there, you know, work with the opposition, work with Parliament to get this done for Canadians.
Are you generally in agreement with the new travel restrictions and the idea of having quarantine hotels?
You know, I watched a clip of Patty Hajdu, the health minister, from March of last year, basically saying that closing the borders would not help the spread of the pandemic. And, you know, fast forward a year to this, you know, the reality is that the toothpaste is out of the tube in Canada. Yeah. Most of our spread of COVID is through community transmission, and we haven't put in place things like rapid testing, and we're behind in vaccinations. Those are the tools that are actually going to stop this. That said, I also don't understand why we haven't put in place more effective measures to deal with travelers. So, you know, I'll point to my home province of Alberta. We have a program where when you arrive in Canada, you still have to quarantine, but you get a test upon arrival. You quarantine, you get another test. And then if you are negative on your second test after a certain period of days, you're allowed to go. And that is a much better way of dealing with variants because, in theory, anybody who tested positive should be tested for the variant at the same time, right? So we actually know what's coming into the country. I don't understand a year in why the government is saying, like, this is acceptable. The other thing I'll say about travel restrictions, lockdowns in general, that the Canadian public should be concerned about is that we're putting these measures in place without any sort of end criteria, right? Like, so, you know, something that impinges on civil liberties, like lockdowns, like travel restrictions, it should be, okay, we're asking the Canadian public to do this until this set of criteria is fulfilled. They should be to buy time.
Yeah.
And we haven't been hearing that from the government. So we need to start understanding what those criteria are and how likely it is for the government to be able to fulfill them. We can't just, I don't think it's fair to just keep asking Canadians to sacrifice more and the government to do less.
All right. Where would you stay in Calgary for 3 nights that it would cost $2,000?
That's kind of bougie, eh? I don't know.
That must be
a good margarita.
That must be a heck of a room. I'd like to see that room.
I know.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle Rempel-Garner. Stay warm.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Yep.